Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Pacelli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, some new data out on the prevalence of diabetes in this country, and as expected, the numbers are on the rise.
Well, that is so unfortunate, but not surprising. The rate of increase of diabetes in this country has gone from roughly 9.8% in 1994 to 14.3% in 2014, and about a third of those patients in the study did not know that they had diabetes.
Perhaps more alarming is the number of Americans with prediabetes, many of whom are also unaware of their condition. 38% of Americans have prediabetes, which can often be reversed with proper diet and exercise interventions. There are many medical underpinnings of these conditions, Margaret, but it's still very much a disease related to behavior.
Well, the study, published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association, did have some promising information. The rate of increase actually has started to level off since 2008. That's due in part to greater awareness of risk factors for diabetes, certainly the focus on obesity in this country. And I think we have to note, since the Affordable Care Act, greater access to preventive care, diagnosis, and disease management.
Intervention and information are key, Margaret. And our guest today is focusing on providing the American health consumer with materials that can inform and educate. Tara Montgomery is the Senior Director of Health Impact at Consumer Reports, the world's largest independent consumer advocacy organization. They've developed resources for American consumers to protect themselves from medical harm, find more affordable prescription drugs, and become more informed health consumers.
Well, these resources are more vital than ever in this emerging area of consumer-driven healthcare, Mark. And of course, Lori Robertson will be seeking ways to better inform us as well. The managing editor of FactCheck.org will stop by. She's always on the hunt for misstatements that are spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Tara Montgomery of Consumer Reports in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. A federal judge has paved the way for a House Republican-led lawsuit against the Obama administration over the Affordable Care Act. The suit, led by House Speaker John Boehner, argued the president overreached in his authority to increase spending on health care measures by billions of dollars. The judge ruled the House could move ahead with its lawsuit, posing another potentially significant challenge to the health care law. If the case moves forward from here, it will be the first time the House has sued an administration over its spending power. And there are further threats in Congress concerning health service funding, with the GOP leadership considering shutting down government over Planned Parenthood funding. There are other health measures at risk once the budget runs out at the end of September. A number of programs aimed at preventing teen pregnancy and providing family planning services are on the block. Upwards of $1 billion in funding for the National Institutes of Health also in jeopardy. A third of American adults are obese or overweight, and that obesity comes with many risks. Earlier onset of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and premature death. Now comes another reason for concern. A recent study showed adults who were overweight at age 50 had a higher chance of succumbing to Alzheimer's disease at an earlier age. Previous studies had already shown a link between midlife obesity and Alzheimer's. This is the first study showing a link between obesity and early onset. Another reason to get the upper hand in the battle of the bulge. Also, smokers with type 2 diabetes increase their risk of the worst effects of the disease, with increased risk of heart disease, heart attack, stroke, or death. A recent study shows simply quitting reduces that increased risk over time. And Monsanto has seen a setback in France, the land of the discerning gastronome. A judge in France has ruled that a farmer exposed to the Monsanto herbicide Lasso suffered toxic and neurological damage as a result. Lasso has been outlawed in France and a number of other countries, including Canada, since 2007. This is the first lawsuit supporting actual physical harm from exposure. Monsanto vowing to take the suit to France's highest court. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Tara Montgomery, Senior Director of Health Impact at Consumer Reports, where she currently oversees the development and information and tools designed to help the public make more informed choices about healthcare. Ms. Montgomery served in numerous roles at Consumer Reports, where she oversaw the launch of several consumer-focused health initiatives, including Consumer Reports Health Rating Center, and also served as publisher of Consumer Reports Health. Ms. Montgomery has served in senior editorial roles in publishing and helped launch Fathom, the pioneering online learning network based at Columbia University. Ms. Montgomery earned her degree at King's College of London, also studied at the London School of Economics and the New School in New York. Tara, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark. It's my pleasure to be here.
That's great. Well, for most of our listeners, I think they may well be aware, Consumer Reports is the world's largest independent product testing and consumer advocacy organization dedicated to helping consumers make more informed choices about the products they consume. And while Consumer Reports has been involved in healthcare space for some time, there's certainly been a sea change for consumers to have a say in both the quality of care and the cost of healthcare they consume. And I'm wondering if you could give our listeners some background on the genesis of Consumer Report Health Division and how Consumer Report's role is evolving in this new era of consumer-driven healthcare.
Yes, well, actually, Consumer Reports was founded in 1936, and ever since our first issue of the magazine, we've covered healthcare. So we rated Alka-Seltzer.
Isn't that great?
Claimed that its claims vanished like the gas bubbles in the air.
Pop, pop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. We still remember that.
That's right. And we've been active in health for decades. So we actually spoke out in favor of universal health care in our magazine back in 1939 and kept working on health issues for decades, but really revved up 10 years ago when we saw the kind of movement of health information coming online for consumers, along with rising costs for consumers in healthcare and a dialogue about reform. And we saw that health was becoming really the number one consumer issue of that decade, and we decided to step up and advocate for consumers. And we did that in a few ways. One, of course, was to join the health reform campaign, and we supported the ACA and made sure it had provisions that protected consumers. We collected stories from consumers to really illuminate the pain that consumers have around their health care and to use those stories to help persuade legislators to pass the ACA. Along with that, we worked hard on transparency, especially as technology meant that data could be more available, and we began to fight through our advocacy division to see more data about clinical trials results, about the safety of hospitals, about infection rates and other things. And we launched a health rating center where we began to do comparisons of health services and products based on science. And then following healthcare reform, we've been trying to help consumers make sense of their role as, quote, consumers of healthcare to become a more empowered health consumer, which is a difficult thing to do. And really working hard to reach diverse audiences, which is not something Consumer Reports has done a lot of in the past. But in healthcare, we knew that if we wanted to reach people who really needed health support, that we needed to cast our net more widely and work with everyone from migrant farm worker groups to unions.
Well, Tara, certainly there was a time in the not-so-distant past when people who had insurance got their card. It was kind of preset for them. But now there's really a daunting set of choices in the healthcare purchases being made by millions of Americans. And some 16 million new consumers have entered the insurance marketplace purchasing insurance online for the first time. And many of these newly insured Americans now have to navigate the health system in a new way. So maybe talk to us a little bit beyond the coverage aspect. How is your organization working to inform the consumer on how best to navigate and utilize the healthcare system? And how are you perhaps helping the healthcare system respond to the needs of these new consumers as well?
Good question. Well, we do want the new exchanges and new plans to succeed. And we collaborate with some of them, including in California, to make sure that they're very usable as systems and that choice is really available. And we're pressing to make sure that plans in those exchanges are really high-value plans for consumers. Beyond that, we really keep an eye on the rates and review rates because cost is an issue, and we are concerned about that. And we watch the quality of networks, because for any given health plan, really the quality of the network leads to other health decisions and other expenses for consumers. And then when they're actually insured and covered, we are interested in making sure that consumers understand what a high-value decision looks like, and then that they're using their plan benefits wisely and their out-of-pocket costs wisely, and ensuring that they get the essential care that they need.
As you've mentioned, there's a sea change going on in the health insurance landscape with the rise of high deductible health plans. And it was sort of suggested that it was going to empower health consumers to be more aware of their costs. And yet, on the other hand, we're seeing where consumers are putting off vital health care due to the increase in pocket costs. And I know we've had Stephen Brill on the show, who did the story in Time magazine, really talking about how complicated it really is to get at the real cost of this. I'm wondering if you could describe some of the more challenging aspects of this trend, and what's the greatest concern you have in the folks at Consumer Reports?
At Consumer Reports, we have seen that data that consumers have been avoiding certain healthcare due to the costs, and we've done our own research that validates that. And we also hear from consumers simply that they're mad about the outrageous cost of their health care. Mm-hmm. And we're very concerned about consumer debt in general, student debt and medical debt, and want to see that reduced. So what we're working on to address a portion of that is fighting for price transparency, which has been a real barrier to consumers being able to make assessments about the kind of care they can afford. And we're making progress on that in different states, including California, where we have a project launching in a few weeks in October on price transparency and high-value care. And then we're working on a campaign around surprise medical bills, which is often an issue where there is a lack of transparency or at least a lack of communication. And we're enlisting consumers to fight that fight with us and see legislative changes to prevent surprise medical bills in different states. And then on a more practical level for consumers, we have two programs. One is called Choosing Wisely, and the other is called Best Buy Drugs, which both really show people how to spend their dollars wisely and avoid unnecessary expenses, because a lot of the time those out-of-pocket costs that they encounter may not have been for necessary care. They may have been for certain kinds of screenings, for example, that could have been avoided. Certainly encouraging consumers to shop around in the reality of this marketplace and not be afraid to ask questions about cost. So we really push consumers to ask those difficult questions about cost. And we also worry about the fact that the burden of costs is shifting to consumers, and that there's this expectation that consumers can take on this so-called consumerist behavior very quickly, when really we're part of a long-term culture shift. And there's a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of providers and payers to support consumers in navigating this and not leave consumers to their own devices just because they're in the marketplace.
Well, Tara, I'd like to go a little deeper into one project that you mentioned, and that was the Choosing Wisely campaign. I understand you actually led the team at Consumer Reports Health that partnered with the ABIM Foundation to launch that campaign. And we always like to give a shout out to Dr. Steve Smith, who's on our medical staff here at our organization in Connecticut, and who is one of the leading proponents in that campaign. And just to expand a little bit on what you said, professional medical associations and patient groups were encouraged to limit the overuse and the overdemand of high-cost tests, or tests of any cost, that are unnecessary in many cases, but also key drivers in the rising cost of care. And some of them actually lead to potentially to medical harm, such as the overprescription of antibiotics. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit more about your organization's role in that campaign, the kind of resources you developed for it. We'd also like to hear about your organization's participation in the Preventing Overdiagnosis Conference at the National Institute of Health, which focused on this issue.
Well, back in 2012, we built a relationship with the ABIM Foundation and agreed that it was important to encourage conversations between healthcare providers and patients about the evidence for safety, the cost and value information for the test treatments and procedures that they're considering. And we love the idea that patients and healthcare providers can be speaking from the same page and looking at the same evidence together as they make decisions together about what's really necessary for an individual. So we actually partner with many specialty medical societies to translate into consumer language the list items that were developed for Choosing Wisely. So Steve Smith, who you mentioned, is a real pioneer in developing this idea of a list of topics that should be avoided or questioned. And we've taken lists from maybe 100 medical societies and created consumer resources that explain why that test, treatment, or procedure may not be necessary and how much these things might cost. So we have created these resources as brochures, as web pages, as videos, as to reach different kinds of consumers at different stages in their health decision making. First, to become aware of the issue of waste and overuse, which is a rather counterintuitive message in a culture where more is considered better. And then ultimately to activate consumers to ask those difficult questions about whether something's really needed. So one of the best examples of how that's beginning to be used is the way that we integrate consumer information into other decision tools at the point of decision making. And that includes some of the transparency tools that certain consumers have access to, like CarSlight Health and Change Health and Healthcare Blue Book. And then electronic medical record systems, which are increasingly including Choosing Wisely resources for providers to print out to have a discussion with consumers. But that behavior needs to change on the provider side primarily and in collaboration with patients. So we are collaborating with ABIM and the societies on that and with a huge partnership network so that we now reach 100 million consumers a year with content and messages around Choosing Wisely. And antibiotics, which you mentioned, is now a real focus area for Choosing Wisely. And we have a grant through Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to work with 7 regional groups to try and reduce the use of antibiotics in upper respiratory and viral infections by 20% over 3 years. And then as for preventing overdiagnosis, which is a movement that's been evolving in parallel with Choosing Wisely, we do look at the overdiagnosis issues and excited by the synergy between the preventing overdiagnosis movement, which really leads to an overtreatment culture, and the conversations about waste and overuse. And Consumer Reports likes to have allies working in the same direction, maybe with different kinds of tactics and different kinds of relationships, but always in dialogue with one another to see how together we can affect the marketplace over time.
We're speaking today with Tara Montgomery, Senior Director of Health Impact at Consumer Reports, where she oversees the development and production of information tools designed to help the public make more informed choices about healthcare. You know, it's fascinating here about the sort of complexity and that Consumer Report has, and with that comes a greater degree of transparency in healthcare professions. We recently had Dr. Christine Casale on the show of the National Quality Forum talking about the need for better outcome measurement data. Still very inconsistent areas for consumers to navigate in medical mistakes. This number is up in an astronomical level, 100,000 deaths per year. Tell our listeners about the work you're doing on patient safety. You've touched on some of that already, how you're providing health consumers with this reliable outcome data.
Consumer Reports is a nonprofit advocacy organization, which some people don't realize. And under the auspices of that, we have an advocacy effort called the Safe Patient Project, where a network of advocates really fight around transparency, legislation, accountability, and public awareness, and have really led fights against hospital-acquired infections with many successes around data disclosure across states and really raised the alarm around medical errors. So we have a network that really fights for the data, which we can then use in ratings for consumers. And we do believe that by making that data available to consumers in a very accessible, meaningful way, that they can learn to make comparisons and make choices in healthcare that will result in them being safer. And there are stories we can tell as a journalism organization to really make consumers more conscious of the safety issues in the system so they can ask questions and advocate for themselves and their loved ones in healthcare settings and try and protect themselves. But ultimately, yes, we do believe that data helps consumers make choices, and it also helps providers understand how they can improve. And that's equally important to us, is that hospitals and physicians and drug manufacturers see publicly how we're talking about safety issues and themselves recognize what consumers need so that they can take the steps they need to improve. So we care very much about outcomes data. We worry that there isn't enough good data out there yet for us to do the best job we can to provide tools and resources to consumers. So we're continuing to ask for better data, and we're very encouraged by efforts to do more patient-centered outcomes research and to release more data, and really applaud people that do that courageously, even if it doesn't seem to be in their short-term interest, because we do know that it's in the long-term interest of the healthcare system. And we sit on many committees around quality and safety at the Institute of Medicine, and in fact, Chris Castle's organization that you mentioned, the National Quality Forum, and we really try and have a patient voice in those forums and ensure that there is improvement going on in the system separate from whether consumers are beginning to shift their own behavior.
Well, Tara, one area where consumers seem to be genuinely mystified, and I think even when providers are in the role of consumers are genuinely mystified, is an area where cost has continued to climb dramatically, and that's with prescription drugs. According to a recent Consumer Reports survey, 75% of Americans say they've had to change their spending habits to accommodate their budgets for higher-priced prescription drugs, and that's led to people simply not buying their prescriptions or even avoiding visits with their providers because of it. Maybe you could talk with us about Consumer Reports' Best Buy Drugs program and the resources you've developed for consumers in that area. How does it work for them?
The Consumer Reports Best Buy Drugs program is a public education program that's been around for 10 years. It's unique in that it's unbiased, and we have found that so many sources of drug information for consumers are funded by pharma, or there's a lot of drug advertising in our culture that leads people to expect or ask for brand name or high-cost drugs that may not be necessary. And so we're one of the few organizations that is able to tell the truth based on the systematic reviews of the evidence for safety and effectiveness, what really is safe, what works, and how there are differences between different kinds of drugs. Often we also conclude that people may not need to start with a drug, and that's something that, again, culturally maybe is not recognized very well by consumers, that there are lifestyle changes that may mean that you don't need to start a drug and you can save money by not starting that drug or coming off a drug when you no longer need it. So we don't only talk about drug choices, we talk about alternatives to drugs. And in every case, we talk about cost. And we do a lot of work in our research department to surface out-of-pocket costs and typical costs for different kinds of drugs and make that all publicly available for free. And we've just created a new resource called Best Drugs for Less, which is bestdrugsforless.org as well. And that includes tips for consumers on ways to save on their drugs, which is another tactic that is not commonly understood, is how consumers can often even not use their insurance and save money, how they can shop at big box stores, how they can negotiate for their drug prices, and other tools and tips to make sure that they're on the most cost-effective solution for their personal situation. So the Best Buy Drugs program is grant-funded and by the Attorneys General Settlement, and we are happy to keep that going in service of consumers who need to find cheaper drugs. And on an advocacy level, there's work to do, which we've begun to do, to speak up against the fast increase in drug prices and certainly the cost of new drugs, biologics, and so on, which are just unfair for consumers. So the Best Buy Drugs program focuses more on commonly used drugs, and then in our advocacy work, we're starting to look at more specialty drugs.
We've been speaking today with Tara Montgomery, Senior Director of Health Impact at Consumer Reports. You can learn more about their work by going to consumerreports.org or follow Tara on Twitter at TaraCRHealth. Tara, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Carly Fiorina has said that some vaccine-preventable diseases are, quote, not communicable and not contagious, and that some immunizations are not necessary for children. But every immunization recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention covers a highly communicable disease. The CDC's recommended schedule for children contains 14 vaccines, and they all include coverage against highly communicable diseases. Fiorina, the former Hewlett-Packard CEO who is running for the Republican presidential nomination, has also suggested on multiple occasions that the vaccine for HPV shouldn't be mandatory for school-aged children. The CDC currently recommends that all boys and girls aged 11 or 12 years old should receive it. The HPV virus is highly communicable through many forms of sexual contact, and the vaccine has been shown to prevent its transmission, protecting against strains of the virus that are known to cause cervical cancer. Fiorina has told a story about her daughter being bullied into letting her own daughter receive the HPV vaccine. In an interview with BuzzFeed, Fiorina said there was a difference between a measles vaccine and a vaccination, quote, when a girl is 10 or 11 or 12 for cervical cancer, just in case she's sexually active at 11. But the vaccine is recommended then because that is before most people become sexually active and before they're at risk. According to the CDC, about 14 million Americans become infected with HPV every year. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children, since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shul stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
I've made this Google Maps mashup. If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map. And by God, something like this got going.
So he founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers in upwards of 40 countries around the world, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
I think we're currently pushing 5,800 identified members in our Google Plus community, and we have followings in the thousands more. We know that we've delivered about 800 hands devices, and we suspect that a comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The movement has grown so rapidly, the simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
We're still working on opposable thumbs. We're still working on individual finger movements. These things grip or ungrip. That's all they do. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge because those expensive devices are typically out of reach for children who would outgrow them. So it doesn't make sense for them to get a $5,000 or $10,000 hand. And, you know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands. And for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking to makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world who might otherwise not be able to afford them. Now that's a bright idea.
The This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.